You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and this is Scrambled Eggs, and this is Melody filling in for Jane this morning, and I'll bring up a song here, and we'll bring up my guest this morning. I'm going to have Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin, and he might be an interesting interview. He ties back a lot of interesting information going back to the JFK assassination. So here we go. Again, that was Give Me Some Truth, and my special guest this morning is Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin, and I've had several interviews with Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin on my program Truth Quest that's on Tuesday evenings from 9 to 11, and it's also all the programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And I'm going to let Colonel Dan Marvin introduce himself and give us a little information on his books and his current book that he's coming out with, and any other information pertinent, because, I mean, that's part of the aspects of going on the radio, so that can kind of get the information out there. And while I'm at it, I'm going to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Colonel Dan.
Well, I do hope and pray, Melody, that whatever we say, that they all do agree with, because we're telling the truth. And hopefully everybody that's listening would like to hear the truth. I'm Colonel Dan Marvin. I retired from the Army in 1973, and I've been working ever since to get the truth out to the American people about those things that they should know about that are important to the future of this country. I retired as a lieutenant colonel. I went in as a private from Syracuse, New York. I never finished high school, but I worked my buns off, and I did my best to honor the truth in everything that I did, good or bad. Anything that I did bad, I did for our government. My book, Expendable Elite, One Soldier's Journey into Covert Warfare, is something I would hope that every American would read, not necessarily buy, although that would be nice, but go to their library and have them get one so that more people can share the knowledge of the truth. And the truth is so strong in this book, Expendable Elite, and let me explain what the title means. My publisher, Chris Milligan of Trine Day, chose the the subject title out of about four of them that I submitted to him. But Expendable Elite basically tells the reader that we're afraid of nobody or nothing, the Green Berets. We were the best trained soldiers in the world. We assumed that everybody that we went up against feared us. The only fear we had was of our own government should they declare us expendable. That's why it's Expendable Elite. They did declare me and my team expendable in June of 1966, and the CIA sent an entire regiment to include anti-tank weapons and everything, and we had no tanks. In fact, the biggest weapon we had was an 81-millimeter mortar in Vietnam. They sent an entire regiment to wipe out my camp, to kill all of us, Americans and Vietnamese, because I had refused a mission to assassinate Cambodian Crown Prince Sihanouk. And I don't know, Melody, whether you want me to go any farther. I could go all day, probably. But that's a basic truth. That's why they took us to court in January of 2006, because they wanted to get that book off the market. They wanted to destroy myself and my publisher and put us into bankruptcy. But I took four boxes of documentation plus audio tapes from the men who themselves were the plaintiffs that proved that they were telling a lie in court. We won the trial, cost us a little over $200,000, which we're still paying off, but it was worth it to us to tell the truth to the American people.
You've got several different aspects of your experience that they can get quite involved, but I, you know, that's an important factor to just let the public know about that. But also, one of the things that you're doing is coming out with a new book, and I was thinking that from the information that you sent me, and of course I read your prior book, Expendable Elite. But are you getting more into the LCDR? Is that the Lieutenant Commander Pitzer?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, there is a book out about the killing of Lieutenant Commander Pitzer called Without Smoking Gun by a friend of mine, Ken Heiner. It doesn't quite go to the extent that I would like it to have, but I didn't author it. But what we did was prove. I was asked on the 5th day of August of 1965, I was asked to kill. I was a special forces trained assassin and terrorist, and that's one of the things that the CIA used special forces for, was as assassins and terrorists and also saboteurs. And I was asked to kill U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer. They told me, this is a CIA agent, that he was about to give secrets to the enemy. Well, if he was going to do that, in my mind, based on the mind control that they had over me, in my mind, he was worth killing. The only thing was that I thought it would be overseas, because we were trained in assassination training that U.S. Army Special Forces officers would be used overseas. I was on orders for Vietnam, and the way it would work, I would get to Vietnam, and then I'd go and take care of this mission, and if I didn't make it back, I'd be dropped from the rolls as a deserter, and if I made it back, it'd be as if I'd never been any place, just as simple as that. And you would carry out your mission in the way that you feel you would do it best. And anyway, I think I lost myself there, Melody. Where was I?
Well, you were talking about how you were asked to assassinate this commander.
Lieutenant Commander, thank you, William Bruce Pitzer. And then I asked him where he was, and he said at Bethesda Army Hospital, Bethesda Naval Hospital. And I said, well, I can't do it then. I said, I've got a wife and three children living right here off post, and if I was to accept this mission, I'd have to leave right away and disappear. And all of a sudden, my wife and three children would wonder where I was. So I said, you know, they're supposed to use the mafia on all stateside assassinations. But for some reason, the CIA was having some problems in dealing with the mafia in this country, so they chose to use Green Berets. Well, Colonel C.W. Patton, who was my commanding officer of the 6th Special Forces Group, on the 5th of August, 1965, he called me to his office, plus one other Green Beret officer, David Vanek, and asked me to go down, and him too, to meet with a CIA agent in the trees near the post headquarters, near the Special Forces headquarters. I walked on down, and David Vanek followed behind me, maybe about 40 feet, and I met with the CIA agent. That's when he asked me if I would kill a man who was about to give secrets to the enemy, and I said certainly, until he told me where it was to be done. I left then, and Captain Vanek came forward. I don't know what they talked about, but when I learned years later that Captain Vanek had all of a sudden been relieved from his duty as a special forces officer and put on a special assignment, which could never have happened if he hadn't been on a mission, because we were restricted to 2 years promised service as a Green Beret when we graduated from Green Beret training. Well, I didn't really know the significance of William Bruce Pitzer until 1993. They had a special program on the JFK assassination, and during that program, right at the very end, they listed a number 42 people that had been killed, that one way or another died a death, who were involved somehow in the assassination or the cover-up. Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer's name was on that list. So I immediately knew that they'd lied to me, that it wasn't a man who's about to give secrets to the enemy. He was part of the cover-up of the JFK assassination. So I immediately sought, and took me a little while, to find his widow. And I told her on the phone, and I recorded both my conversations with her. In fact, those conversations were played at the trial where the special operations people wanted to get this book off the market. But I played that actual audio tape where I told her that I was asked to kill her husband, but I was not the one that did it, but why he was killed, and the fact that she told me, and this is very important, that three different Navy intelligence officers had told her that she was not to discuss her husband's death, which they called a suicide. She was not to discuss her husband's death with anybody, not even her family. Now, why was she asked not to discuss her husband's death with her family if he had just died a suicide death? There was a lot of things wrong with the whole thing. I pointed them out to Kent Heiner. He wrote the book Without Smoking Gun. And myself and Dennis David, who is a retired naval officer, who I hope is still alive, he actually stood next to William Bruce Pitzer, the evidence that the CIA wanted to destroy and then kill him once they'd find it. The evidence actually was the actual pictures, motion pictures and stills of the Kennedy autopsy, the real autopsy, that William Bruce Pitzer had taken through a surveillance camera that was hidden, that was outside of the autopsy room, and he recorded that, and he actually showed those to Dennis David. Dennis David and I met in Ithaca, New York in 1993, and we have since then tried our best to get some congressman or some senator, and I hope one of you listeners are one, that has the courage to call us forward in front of Congress so we can tell them the truth about the JFK assassination and even more about the Martin Luther King assassination, which our government was 70% accountable for, was the Martin Luther King assassination.
Now, how did that tie into the Martin Luther King assassination, and why you would be so apt and have knowledge on that? Because you, in my interviews with you in the past, you have a tendency to not say anything unless you've got proof to back it up.
Oh, that's right. Oh, I make sure of that. When they took us to trial, I took four boxes of documentation plus those audio tapes. Martin Luther King, the different story. In 1967, shortly, just 7 months after I got back from Vietnam, I was asked to go to Thailand to the 46th Special Forces. Now, I didn't usually have them send me or approve of them sending me anyplace, except there was a lot of trouble, it was danger or something. And I asked him why they wanted me to go to the 46th Special Forces in Thailand, and he said, the man from the Office of Personnel Operations said, we can't tell you. It's just too sensitive, but you'll find out as soon as you get there. Well, I got on that airplane, and I got into Thailand, into Bangkok, and then took a jeep up to Lop Buri, Thailand, which people that are familiar with Thailand know that's the monkey capital of Thailand. And the 46th Special Forces headquarters is there near Lop Buri. When I went into the office that I would be taking over in the 46th Special Forces, there was a box there that was about the size that, you know, like an M1 rifle would go into it or more. And I asked Lieutenant Crummy, C-R-U-M-M-E-Y, who would be my assistant there in my new position, what the box was there for. And he said, well, that belongs to Captain Butler, and he'll be sending that home to Detroit with the U.S. mail. And I said, with the U.S. mail? What's in it? And he said, weapons. I said, open it up. He opened it up, and there's four different weapons to include an M1D sniper scope, which is a 30-caliber, powerful rifle, one of the best sniping rifles you could get in those days. And it turned out, when I did a little bit, had a little bit of discussion with him and Lieutenant Crummy and the warrant officer, that Captain Butler had shipped home over 120 weapons. These weapons were American weapons that had been captured by the enemy in Vietnam and then captured back from the enemy in Vietnam, and the special forces in Vietnam were shipping them to the special forces in Thailand to turn them over to Captain Butler, and I was relatively certain, I couldn't prove it, that these rifles were part of the system that the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence of the United States Army set up to kill Martin Luther King. And they were used to infiltrate black militant units so the CIA could get, using special forces, black special forces officers could get intelligence on what those units were doing, what those black militant units were doing. And also, two special forces reserve A teams were called to active duty and used to follow Martin Luther King during his entire time there where he was killed. And, in fact, William Pepper wrote a book, Orders to Kill, and it's got the details in it. And they were to tail him 24 hours a day, and if the shooter missed, they had orders to kill. These are special forces. This was all brought out in trial, along with about a half-inch thick FBI investigation about that weapon shipment that I'd turned over to the FBI, and that was all given to Dr. Pepper to use when he represented the King family, and they proved in the Memphis court that our government was 70% complicit in the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, who in my judgment was a real hero. Anybody who could lead his people against armed units, police and military, and have the courage to do that is a hero in my mind.
Okay, now, can we go back a little bit more into the information that you were trying to present on the JFK assassination? Because, now, is it correct that you had evidence that President Bush was there in Dealey Plaza?
I don't have any
firm
evidence.
Okay, but give us a little background and what you have on that.
Oh, one of the problems is there are a few people in the CIA who I could trust implicitly. If I were ever to release their names, especially the one that we're talking about right now that gave me the information not only about Kennedy's whereabouts or his connections with the CIA prior to him admitting it, but also were the ones that informed me when the CIA, other elements, had set up a ambush just this side of the Cambodian border to kill General Dang, Quang Van Dang, and myself. Now, General Dang was the one that actually rescued all of us, me and my team, the Vietnamese Special Forces team, and about 358 Buddhist Wahao irregulars that were working for me in my camp in An Phu, Vietnam. General Dang, I went up to get him, to bring him across that border, and that's when a CIA agent, the day before I left to go up there, let me know that we were going to be ambushed when we came across that border. Well, the reason that I was able to finally get General Dang into this country had to do with George Herbert Walker Bush. I had found out where General Dang was. He was under threat of assassination by the CIA. He was in Montreal, Quebec, working as a janitor and a bookkeeper. This was the second most powerful man in Vietnam in 1973. He was in the last helicopter to come out of Vietnam when the communists took it over. And he was up there working under an assumed name, like I said. And when I finally found him, I wrote the Justice Department because a friend of mine, Mary Magdalene Jordan, had gone to Ottawa to get information on why General Dang was being kept in Canada, forced to stay there, or just to go back to Vietnam where he was facing an immediate death threat from the Vietnamese government. And I have a copy of that in writing. And Mary Magdalene Jordan went up Ottawa, saw all the records of General Dang, the false allegations. In fact, a lady up there asked her why the U.S. government, thinking that Mary Magdalene Jordan worked for the U.S. government, why they didn't provide her with some proof. Well, as soon as that was reported to me, I wrote a letter to the State Department and the Justice Department demanding an investigation across every agency of our government to clear General Dang of all those false allegations. For 11 months, I never heard anything back on that letter, any action at all. So I wrote President George Herbert Walker Bush on the, I think it was the 16th day of June of 1989, and I took this letter, by the way, to the federal court during my trial and read it to the jury. It was read to the jury. And I I wrote in the letter that I would not give up in my struggle to free General Dang of all the erroneous, different words, but the false allegations, those were the words, that were against him from the United States that kept him in Canada under threat of assassination. And I said I would not give up until either I died or the Lord returned and took me up. I'm a born-again Christian. And I slipped a little piece of pink paper in with that letter, and I hand-wrote on that, "I am intimately familiar with your role in the CIA prior to your admitting it publicly." Now, the information I had from people within the CIA not only stated that George Herbert Walker Bush was in Dallas the day that Kennedy was killed, but he's also deeply involved, along with his family banks, in what I called the billion-dollar scam, which after I reported people involved in that scam and everything to the FBI in Ithaca, New York, and then was asked by the FBI to pretend like I never talked to him, and three of the people's names who I'd given the FBI ended up dead within a month. All these things evolved when President George Herbert Walker Bush was in office.
I find interesting that you said that, okay, here you knew about this information, and yet these people ended up missing, but why didn't you end up dead?
Because the Lord protected me. I didn't even start on any of this until the day that my youngest daughter, Dana Lee, led me to the Lord Jesus Christ. And it was a miracle. All of a sudden, I was in the front of a U-Haul truck with my daughter when she led me to the Lord, and all this information had been just piling up inside my head about things that I was personally involved in or personally had knowledge of. There were illegal activities by our government, but I did not dare write a thing about them because they would have sent somebody like me, a trained assassin or the mafia, hitman, to kill me. And I had met with the mafia. I knew the mafia pretty well, at least up in the Boston area. Met with a Don one time. But I was afraid that they'd do that to me until that day that I got saved and Jesus Christ entered my heart. And I just turned over my protection to him. And he's done a beautiful job. And I had an FBI agent in my office in Ithaca, New York, in the late 1990s. And he asked me when he was investigating this billion-dollar scam, he says, "Aren't you worried that they'll put a bomb under your car?" And I told him, "You just don't understand how it works." Now, up until that time, the whole history of the CIA, they'd only had 5 men killed in the line of duty. They used mafia hitmen, and they used, and this will be in the new book that Jeff Wooster's writing, and they used Special Forces Green Berets. They used the Green Berets overseas mostly, and the mafia almost 100% of the time for any killing they wanted done here in the United States. Well, I knew the Lord was a lot bigger and could protect me more than a whole division of armed forces, because he can do it. And I gave myself to him and asked him to come into my heart as my personal savior, and I have not worried one iota since then. Just the reason I didn't worry at the trial either.
Well, one of the reasons why, you know, you were sticking up for this, Cambodian leader, was because of his involvement with saving your life, correct?
Oh, General Cong Van Dang. No, he's Vietnamese.
Oh, okay, Vietnamese, okay.
He saved my life, my team's life, the Vietnamese Special Forces team, and 358 Vietnamese irregulars.
And so you were returning the favor to him.
Once I found out where he was and that he was in danger, absolutely. I owed it to him. I owed it to the truth.
Right.
And make certain.
And even before you had been converted over, you must have had a good reputation for carrying out your word and, you know, trying to do the right thing as you saw it at that point in time.
Well, I'll give you a little example. That's true, what you said. During the trial, the senior attorney for the U.S. Army Special Forces or Special Operations was in the back of the courtroom. The trial had not started yet. We were waiting for the judge to start it. And he turns to his son, who was another attorney. Now, the senior attorney had represented Special Forces for 21 years, and his son was just starting into the program. And then they had a local attorney from Spartanburg, South Carolina, and the senior attorney turned to his son. He says, "I didn't think Marvin would show up." Well, I can understand why he thought that, but he didn't know that I heard him say that. I walked over to him, and I got my nose about half an inch from his nose, and I just looked him in his eyes, and I told him, "Look, you know, you forgot something. I used to be one of you, and I used to be the biggest, baddest one of you." And I just turned around and went back to my side of the courtroom, because I never feared a soul. It was up to them to fear me, is the way I figure it. And that's the way special forces are supposed to be, because they're supposed to be the kind that will cause things to happen even before they shoot a bullet.
This is a common practice going on around the world and has been since you became involved in it, correct?
Yes. Interestingly enough, my publisher and I, Chris Milligan, a very courageous man, he and I were the only ones that ever showed up in court against the special operations people. That's why that man said to his son, "I didn't think Marvin would show up," because the people never did. They were afraid of the repercussions of showing up, otherwise ending up nose up in a grave.
So it's almost to the point that those that live through these sort of incidents and that sort of, there's a good reason why at least they live or live as long as they do if they stand up against these people.
I don't know of any other that has to this extent, but it's like when I met with a mafia don outside of Boston, Massachusetts, Mr. Perini, and he offered Master Sergeant Joe Hill and I a job as a hit team for the mafia. He says, "Look, you do it for the government, why not do it for me, and you get paid a lot more." But we refused the job, and we all had, we took a blood oath that we would never tell our names until the other was dead, and he is dead. But I told him, I said, "I understand how the mafia operates." I said, "There's total loyalty or death." And that's the way it is in special operations.
Okay. Well, I guess I was referring more or less to just being a whistleblower in certain respects, because it isn't just, it goes across the board that way, because there's a lot.
Oh, I understand.
Yes.
You know, when Chris Milligan, I wrote the book, it took 4 years using all the secret and top secret and not secret information that I mailed home to a friend of mine at Fort Bragg, and he kept it sealed until I got home. And he was only to unseal it, or an attorney, unseal it if I died in Vietnam, because I'd want them to make sure that it was the enemy that killed me and not friendlies. And they had all this evidence that's in the book, basically. And it took me 4 years to develop the first manuscript. It took 13 years of refusals from 102 publishers, absolutely refused to publish that book, primarily because of the CIA involvement. And when E.J. McCarthy tried to run it through his committee three times to get it published by Presidio, the world's largest publisher of nonfiction military material, he finally called me. He said, "Dan, I've run it through the third time and they refuse to publish it unless you take the CIA out of it." And I told him if I took the CIA out of it, it wouldn't be worth publishing. So I said, "Why don't you write me and tell me that?" So he did as good as he could. He wrote me a letter, which I presented to the court at the trial, in which he said that they could not publish it because of the spooky nature of the information in there. Well, you know what we call the CIA spooks, right? So it's not easy, because you're going up against people who are not used to losing. And it doesn't necessarily have to be right or wrong. You know, we were taught basically that all covert operations are voluntary, number one. that all of them are necessary so that our flag can fly over the U.S. Capitol. I mean, we were brainwashed to the extent that no matter who they ask you to kill or organization to destroy or whatever, that it was the only thing to do, that you had to volunteer to do it. You had absolutely no protection, like Colonel Tuttle told me when I accepted the independent operation in Vietnam on Christmas Day of 1965, the day after Christmas, 1965. After he told me what it was all about and I accepted the mission, he says, you know, when you leave this door, it will be as if I never met you. And if you get caught inside of Cambodia, you or your men, you will be dropped as deserters. If you are injured, you can get no medical support. There'll be no artillery support, no ground support, no support at all. And you're volunteering to do this. Well, that's the kind of thing that they did.
Now, one of the things that I believe this was in the book had something to do with you being trained with an assignment over it in Egypt. Is that correct?
Oh, the Aswan High Dam. I commanded the very first. This will be in Jeff's book, by the way.
Okay.
I commanded the very first portable atomic weapons team in the U.S. Army Special Forces. And the team was an 8-man team. You carried a portable atomic bomb. The bomb itself I carried weighed 75 pounds. The trigger mechanism weighed 35 pounds, and the XO of the team would carry that. And our contingency mission was to blow the hydroelectric plant that was being built on the Aswan High Dam by the Russians. Interestingly enough, we never had the mission activated. It was a mission where you drop in from 30,000 feet with special parachute gear and everything else and hone in on the Aswan High Dam, dig yourself a shelter within 15 minutes of the dam itself and try not to be caught digging that shelter. Because when you hit the trigger on that atomic bomb, which is equivalent to 10 kilotons, 10 tons of TNT, you only had 15 minutes to get to safety. Which, I mean, it was a suicide mission, and we knew that, but we knew it was in our minds anyway because of how they taught us that it was an important mission for the United States of America. Interestingly enough, this was in 64. Later that year, I met with the Mafia Don, or the January 65. It was right close to there. And he told me of his involvement, after I questioned him somewhat, on having been asked by the CIA to send a company of his construction engineers to Egypt to work with the Russians, who were our enemy at the time, on the Aswan High Dam. And his primary mission, and it surprised me at the time, was to get the blueprints for the hydroelectric plant so he could send those blueprints to the CIA, who would then send them to my Special Forces group, and they would be given to me as part of that contingency plan, so I would know exactly where to put that bomb, not only to destroy the hydroelectric plant, but it would actually contaminate the waters of the Nile River. And how many million people would have died?
Interestingly enough, and I, you know, this may not be related to anything that you do, but then it just reminds me of, if I'm not mistaken, with the World Trade Center, that the Bin Ladens were involved with the reconstruction after the first bombing, and so I would say this kind of ties in a little bit on related type info, and it goes to show that you can't trust anybody. So you think you have.
You've got to be selective, that's for sure. I mean, when the very best forces in the United States military are used to do terrible deeds secretly under covert operations with no written permission or anything else, no budgets, no nothing else that any American would ever see, it does not speak too well of our society, that's for sure. And I don't know anything about the Twin Towers.
Well, I realize
that. But I do know about the federal building.
Okay, go into that.
Because I was a Green Beret trained in special demolitions. There's two very special demolitions that I wish that Congress would call me or any other Green Beret who had the guts to go forward and tell them about: the earmuff charge, which is where you diametrically oppose two charges of C4 plastic explosive on a column, like in that building, that federal building. And when you trigger that with identical leads to the trigger, the power of those two explosives going into the center of that post are multiplied 4 or 5 times and just blow that post right apart. And the other was a dust initiator charge, which they trained us by taking a 40-pound bag of sawdust and putting it into a box car, putting an incendiary charge within that bag of sawdust that would cause the sawdust to be completely impregnated with an incendiary, and then another explosive charge. You'd blow the first charge first and then spread that sawdust throughout that whole boxcar, and then you have an igniter charge, and the boxcar itself becomes a bomb. That's what happened at the federal building, I feel very strongly in my heart. I wasn't there. But it'd be interesting if the federal government would tell why there was no FBI in their offices at that time of day that it went down.
One of the other questions that brought up, okay, when you were trained for these tactics, did you have drills, dry run drills and that sort?
We actually blew up a boxcar.
Okay, so...
We did everything right then and there. We tested it all except the atomic bomb. Now, the atomic bomb, this was interesting. I'm glad that you asked that question, because the scientist who had come up with the concept of the SATM, the Special Atomic Demolition Munitions is what it's called, it's a portable atomic bomb, that bomb, he brought one of those bombs down to my 6th Special Forces group into my office and briefed me and the other 7 men on my team about that bomb. And it's interesting because I had a 15-minute timer, which was from a Maytag or Sears Roebuck, whatever, I forget now, I got it in my notes, washing machine timer. And 15 minutes was all that you had. Now they changed that so you could have it up to 2 hours. And there's a man here in Syracuse, New York, out of 10,000, approximately, active duty or retired Green Berets, he's the only one willing to go with me before Congress. He was on the team that I first commanded. 2 years later, he was on that team as an enlisted man, and they had their atomic bomb had a up to two-hour, you can put any time element you wanted, so it wasn't as much a suicide mission later on as it was when I had it. But he brought that bomb and told us how that was actually the trigger to the hydrogen bomb. That's what that SATM was. And he came up with the idea of tailoring it with a special backpacks for the trigger and the bomb itself for us to carry into a country that we could actually go in by parachute and destroy anything that our government wanted to destroy secretly. In fact, the first one, I think it was, you know, he didn't say this, but I think it was designed with that short time fuse so they'd wipe out the people that took it in at the same time they wiped out the target.
Okay, there's several different avenues that I kind of wanted to just kind of briefly get over before the, you know, our interview comes to an end. But one of them that I kind of wanted to breach around is what, I mean, these guys have a tendency, our governments or anybody, have a tendency to do things over and over again, because if it worked before, it worked, you know, it'll work again. And they have a lot of factors there that seem to be conducive. Like, one, if you know, if you've been assassinated somebody, you can never speak of it because...
Oh, no, it's murder.
Right.
It's the statute of limitations. In the new book, by the way, we will have a typical assassination mission played out in the book. So you can see the intricate detail they go to and who actually chooses the weapons and all that kind of stuff. And how it's done so the American people will never, ever know who ordered it done, because it was never ordered done. It was, you were always asked to do it.
And another factor, when you got into your training, when you were back for early on, they had to tie in with being told about the JFK assassination.
Right. Yeah, the two CIA instructors during the assassination portion of the training, which was in a special building, an old wooden building surrounded by concertina wire and with two guard dogs running around there to chase anybody out that tried to get within earshot. And they told us flat out that the CIA used four mafia hitmen, one who I know personally, Jimmy Files, and two of the mafia hitmen were from the United States, and one of them was on the grassy knoll. One, this will surprise you if I hadn't told you before, one was on the rooftop of the building adjacent to the building that they claimed that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy from, Texas Book Depository, and he was standing with three FBI agents when he fired his shot from that building at Kennedy. It was Jimmy Files, though, on the grassy knoll who actually killed Kennedy, and he is one of those that, with me, has tried to get in front of Congress. He's in prison in Joliet, Illinois right now, the Joliet prison, maximum security. But those kind of things are just, they're kept quiet, they're kept mostly through fear.
Well, it sounds to me like, from my understanding from reading other information around this event, like they had like a triangulation situation going on for the execution of him, and that...
Let me correct you there. As far as triangulation, mm-hmm. What it was a two more hit zones.
Okay.
They had the one there in front of the Texas Book Depository, where he was actually killed. Then they had two Corsican mafia men, each one with a lookout man from the Corsican mafia with high-powered binoculars. They were on the two different routes that sedan could have taken to get to the hospital where they took JFK. They were determined, the spotter would determine whether or not he thought Kennedy would live. And if he told the hitman that to shoot, he would shoot and kill Kennedy for sure before he got to the hospital.
Okay, and so...
This was told to us by the CIA. In fact, they also told us that Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy. He actually worked for the CIA.
Okay, and then the reason why that the Commander Pitzer was... executed was because, or assassinated was because of his involvement in videotaping
the actual autopsy, which will leave no doubt in anybody's mind. Like Dennis David told me, he knew without any doubt that would prove to the American people and the world, really, that Kennedy was assassinated, and those tapes were going to be put on worldwide television once he retired, once Pitzer retired, and he was due to retire within a month or two after he was killed.
Okay, and that video revealed that there was multiple shots. Is that what
I don't know what it revealed.
Okay.
But All I know is what Dennis David told me. It'll leave no doubt in anybody's mind that Kennedy was assassinated.
Okay, and...
It disproved the Warren Commission, basically.
All right. So that's my question is, okay, so we push to have these guys held accountable, but it seems like any time they have some kind of a commission of sorts, it gets buried. And
well, they're stacked. You know, it's just like, well, I had helped to get about four families of Vietnamese into this country through a lady named Alicia Cooper, who headed up the West Coast branch of the International Rescue Commission. And when I finally found Major Foy Van Lee, who was my counterpart in Vietnam, and who is the only man alive that could testify, which he did in writing at my trial, that we were asked by the CIA, by Walter McKim personally, to kill Prince Sihanouk. When I finally found him going through the former ambassador of the United States, Bowie Zim, Bowie Zim gave me the telephone number for the Wahao Central Committee in the United States, and I called that number, and the man who answered the phone, I just love it. I told him I was trying to find Major Foy Van Lee, and he said, his nephew is standing next to me. And he was. Well, so I filled in, and finally, you know, found out exactly where he was and everything else, and Alicia Cooper started paperwork to get him into this country, and she went to a staff meeting in New York City for the International Rescue Committee, where Henry Kissinger is a member of the board of directors. Henry Kissinger is, without a doubt, in my mind, the most evil man in the whole world. I mean, anyway.
You're not alone in that.
Right.
Like.
But anyway, Henry, she came back from the meeting. She called me. She says, Dan, I can't do anything for Major Foy. And I said, why? Said, Henry Kissinger personally ordered that he not be allowed in this country. Of course, she knew, and I knew why. It's because he and I could go against the CIA and tell the truth about the assassination plot against Prince Sihanouk, which I told about in my book. So she said, but I know somebody who can help you. It was another lady. And believe it or not, except for Chris Milligan, no other man has helped me at all to get the truth out, except for, for heaven's sakes. Anyway, one of the senators, who's no longer a senator, wrote to the CIA and tried to help me. But so she gave me the name of Dr. Judith Ledinsky, and I said, well, make sure when you tell her that I'm going to call her, tell her that she's going up against the CIA and Henry Kissinger. And so she did, and when I called Dr. Ledinsky, I told her the same thing. She said, you let me worry about that. And it so happened that she was the chairman of the Joint United States-Vietnam Scientific Cooperation Committee. Our government, more than anything, wanted to be involved with Vietnam on the scientific situation. And so she went over to Vietnam, met with Major Foy Van Lee personally, and made sure that it took a while, but made sure that he and his wife and four children got into this country with permanent entry visas so that could never be recalled. He's living in Wichita, Kansas. They're all U.S. citizens, all working for this country.
Now, and one other factor, and I think, I believe you were telling me that it led to you coming out with this follow-up book, had a lot to do with Westmoreland. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, we better have a separate program for that. I do not want to get... General Westmoreland, I tried to get him general court-martialed for aiding the enemy, which he personally admitted in his own biography, and he wrote the biography, and anybody that's listening to you can go to the library if they don't have it and get the book A Soldier Reports, and he admits in that book that he was ordered not to tell the Congress and not to tell the press that our president, was giving the enemy sanctuaries all up and down the Vietnamese border with Cambodia, and permitting the enemy to use the Mekong River as their major source of resupply for those very same forces who would then shoot at our people across the border, and we couldn't shoot back.
One of the things that I...
That was General Westmoreland should have resigned his commission rather than allow 58,000 men to die when the enemy had the right to them not going after them when they fired at them, just disappearing into Cambodia.
Okay. So one of the things that it seems to come out to me, and I may be coming up with the wrong assumption or not, but you have your troops over there finding out that, or seeing a lot of things there that don't make sense or that seem to go against their reasoning for being there, and then they come back home, and those that protest the action of our government get thrown in with being... it's kind of like a psychological black ops against people.
That's why it's all so secret. They look like they're enemies of the state.
Right. And it's really tough to try to start sorting this out because they're bringing the information out. And in the meantime, it's just feeding those that are being the real traitors.
Well, you know, think on this. And you listeners, think on this. If I had wanted to just avoid any problems with the U.S. government, if I wanted to avoid that $200,000 that it cost us to win that trial, all we had to do was either pull the book off the market or say that it was really a fictional book, and we would have been free. We insisted on going to that trial. Our families were terribly upset about that because they worried that we couldn't possibly win against the U.S. government. But we went because we wanted the truth proved in federal court, and it was. And our entire, this is important for people listening. They can go to our website, expendableelite.com. The entire transcript of that trial, which we paid $2,500 for, is on that website. Anybody can read on there everything that I said, that the plaintiff said, that the attorney said. It's all right in that document, right there for the whole world to see.
Well,
but it's, you see, we're not afraid. Yeah. Almost everybody is, and they have reason for it.
Well, Colonel Dan, you need to be commended for this, and along with Chris Milligan, because he's put out a lot of good books that speak the truth. And I hope we can do this again. And if there's any closing comments that you'd like to make, please do so. And
okay.
Thank you very much.
I'll refer the people to one other book. It's about Barry Seal. It's called Barry and the Boys. And it's about a man named Barry Seal who ran the big drug trafficking rings for the CIA. And when he was about to come public with it, they made sure he died. He was not saved. He didn't have the Lord on his side, and I'm sorry for him. But that's one of the books that Chris referred me to prove that he was okay. When he asked if he could, he actually asked me if he could publish his book, my book.
Wow. Now he's come out with some really great great works that,
right.
and to back you in this situation, it's probably almost unheard of, I would figure, so that you know with that kind of an expense.
Yeah, he did not have to go to court. My attorney got us on a conference call and he said, Chris, Colonel Marvin has protected you 100% with his copyright. You need not answer this court action. You're not involved. And he said, if I could believe in him enough to publish his book, I believe enough in him to go with him to defend it.
Well, again, Colonel Dan, I want to thank you for coming on the program and giving our audience a little insight into your books, Expendable and Elite, and your new book is...
The Devious Elite.
The Devious
That'll
Elite.
Be out next year, right?
Oh, okay. So it's a little ways. We're a little premature on that.
Oh, yeah. It's okay. The early months of 2011.
Okay, well, again.
I'm still working. The one biggest chapter in it is about Jenna Westmore, and I'm still working on the information to send to Jeff so he can write that one.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Colonel Dan.
You take care. God bless him.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.